I next met with Dr. John Leonard to address as many questions as possible on indolent and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and we began with perhaps the most common question about follicular lymphoma. You probably won't be surprised that one of the most common questions we got was, quote, optimal role of bendamustine upfront or in relapse. We got a bunch of cases, for example, 59-year-old man with bulky follicular lymphoma but minimally symptomatic, optimal regimen, and this person says RCVP versus BR.
So bendamustine is clearly very active in follicular lymphoma in the relapse setting, in the refractory setting. The question of where it fits in the upfront setting, I think, is becoming more clear, although not entirely determined. As the audience may know, there was a large German study that randomized patients to CHOP-R versus BR. This took several hundred patients, mostly with follicular lymphoma. Some of them had other indolent histologies, as well as mantle cell lymphoma. It suggested that BR was better tolerated than R-CHOP, particularly with respect to alopecia, cytopenias, infections, and the PFS was improved compared to R-CHOP. Now, this study hasn't been fully published at this point. We've seen it presented at meetings, and there's actually a large confirmatory study going on, which will also provide us some more information. So at least by this one report, we have evidence that BR is better tolerated and more effective with respect to PFS than R-CHOP. So many people have started to use bendamustine rituximab as initial therapy on this basis. Others have argued, well, let's wait and see the more mature data. We've been using R-CHOP for a long time. We'd like some longer-term follow-up with more patients. So I think both BR and R-CHOP remain appropriate treatments for patients with follicular lymphoma with respect to initial treatment. Now, how this compares to RCVP, my assumption would be that R-CHOP is more effective than RCVP. And so if you believe that R-bendamustine is better than R-CHOP, by extension, R-bendamustine would be better than RCVP. I think that's a reasonable assumption, but obviously not definitively shown. So where I'm using R-bendamustine these days really, A, is in the older patient with mantle cell lymphoma, I think where you're not curing patients, and when you have a number of different options, I think it's R-bendamustine and mantle cell lymphoma's initial treatment makes a lot of sense. In follicular lymphoma, I think on the basis of the one study that we just mentioned, for older patients who need chemotherapy, I think R-bendamustine is a very good choice. And I'm using less and less RCVP, and I think R-CHOP is certainly reasonable for patients where I'm concerned about transformation. So in a follicular lymphoma patient where I'm worried about transformed disease, I will still use R-CHOP versus R-bendamustine. Where I struggle is in the younger patient because we have less data on long-term marrow outlook. What's the risk of secondary malignancies and marrow suppression and myelotoxicity in the long term with R-bendamustine? And so that's a place where I still think twice a little bit about using BR upfront, although in some patients, particularly those that need chemotherapy and really don't want to have any alopecia, I go ahead and use it, but I do recognize that our data are more limited. Now, whether or not you're going to use in a minimally symptomatic patient single agent rituximab, I think that's still a reasonable choice, and then using a chemo-based regimen down the line. So I certainly do, in selected patients, use single agent rituximab, particularly those patients with disease that need some therapy, but perhaps they're not very sick to the point that they need chemotherapy.
So just from the information we have on this question, then in this 59-year-old man, what do you think he maybe most likely would be doing?
I think in a 59-year-old man, it really depends on his approach. I think that single-agent rituximab is reasonable if he has low bulk disease but needs therapy. Watch and wait is also reasonable if he doesn't need therapy. I think he's on the edge of bendamustine rituximab versus R-CHOP, and what would really sway me would be my concern for transformation and any other comorbidities he'd had. You know, off the top of my head, I'd probably say half the time for that patient, I would pick bendamustine rituximab and half R-CHOP. I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer, but it would really be focused on my concern about transformation, whether or not he had cardiac disease, whether or not alopecia was a big deal for him, and the issue of potential for long-term marrow issues and comfort level with that.
And there's a number of questions here that kind of relate to a bunch of things you just brought up. The first one is, in recurrence in FL, when do you obtain biopsy to rule out transformation?
So So I think a PET scan in follicular lymphoma is most indicated in my mind when I'm worried about transformation. And that is that if I think a patient has disease that could have transformed, a PET scan will be very helpful in telling me, do I need to biopsy the patient and where should I biopsy? So I will do a PET scan in relapsed patients when I'm worried about transformation and thinking a biopsy is necessary. The patient hasn't had a biopsy in a while, high LDH, B symptoms, bulky disease in certain areas. And I'll do the PET scan and I'll look at the highest SUV area. And while there's overlap, if I'm seeing SUVs 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, that kind of range, I'm less concerned about transformation. If I'm seeing SUVs 12 or above, then I would be more concerned about transformation. Obviously, there's a gray area there in the middle, but I think that's a very useful scenario. I saw a patient the other day who had a biopsy of a site with an SUV of 4 that showed follicular lymphoma, but had another site that showed an SUV of 14 elsewhere. And I'm sending her for another biopsy of that SUV 14 area because I'm concerned that what was already biopsied isn't reflective of a possible transformation that may be in a different site with a higher SUV.
So continued related questions, are there any data that rituximab can prevent transformation from low-grade to high-grade lymphoma?
Unfortunately, in my mind, there's no evidence that anything can prevent transformation from low-grade to aggressive lymphoma. There's not definitive evidence that either treating the patient versus observing, or treating with one regimen or another, or treating with an anthracycline versus not, or using rituximab versus not, affects the risk of transformation. And so you could argue, though, that patients with rituximab live longer and do better, and so some of that might be attributable to less transformation, but I think the data supporting that directly really do not exist, to my knowledge.
So I guess that answers the next question. Does CHOP lead to less transformation than bendamustine? What about this question? Is CHOP less leukemogenic than bendamustine? You were referring to that issue before.
Well, the data with CHOP and secondary malignancies suggests that the rate of leukemia downstream is very low. I think if you look at patients that only get CHOP, so for instance, the patients with large cell lymphoma that are cured and only get one cycle of chemotherapy, the secondary malignancy rate is low, very, very low. I think the issue is in follicular lymphoma where they get CHOP and then they get something else and then they get something else, you're really looking at the total exposure and the total risk, which is hard to attribute. Now, where bendamustine fits on that, we don't know. You would expect that since it is an alkylator, that it will have some potential to cause secondary leukemias. I think we look forward to the randomized trials of BR versus R-CHOP that will show that information down the line. Do you ultimately get fewer secondary malignancies? So as of now, it's an unanswered question, but one we certainly think about when we see these patients.
Here's another one. How worried are you now about PML with rituximab?
I personally am not worried about PML with rituximab. PML is progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, initially identified with HIV, and it's an unremitting, debilitating neurologic condition where they basically have cranial nerve palsies and almost a dementia type of picture that is essentially a fatal disease, and patients progress with it relatively rapidly. Presumably has some infectious component to it, which has been on very rare occasions associated with rituximab, but it is a black box warning on the rituximab label that this can happen. I have seen a case of it in one of the patients we treated here, actually someone who got it for ITP and had not had chemotherapy. So that was an interesting observation and a very sad, difficult case because, as the audience knows, PML is a very serious, really essentially fatal disease with a very challenging management course. But reality, for an individual patient, the chance of getting PML is so low that it's not something that I spend a lot of time talking about with the patients or thinking about, because really trying to put those numbers into perspective is not something that I think is particularly relevant to an individual patient.
Here's a practical one. How are you doing scans and the follow-up of lower grade lymphomas?
The issue of how to follow patients with any type of lymphoma, I think, is quite controversial. I was at the Lugano meetings where we had a workshop discussing staging and monitoring, and there was a huge discussion about should we ever do any scans in any patient with lymphoma once they're in remission, given that monitoring somebody with surveillance scans for any histology is of dubious benefit, since the vast majority of patients who relapse and need therapy, whether it's follicular lymphoma, large cell lymphoma, Hodgkin's lymphoma, most patients present with a physical finding or a symptom or a laboratory finding that prompts one to pursue it and identifies the relapse. Somewhere in the range of 10% of relapses at best are relapses that are only found on a CT scan or a PET scan for that matter that you would have no clue about if you had done a careful physical exam and history, et cetera. And so whether or not finding those 10% of relapses any earlier changes the long-term outcome for a patient has not been shown, to the point that some people say, once I get a negative scan, I don't scan at all. So for a patient with follicular lymphoma specifically, I think it's quite challenging. I think I would do scans if the patient has a symptom or a sign that they've progressed, or if you're particularly worried about them. Remembering the pretest likelihood of finding a false positive versus a true positive finding really relates to what's the risk of relapse. So if you have a patient who's gotten a good regimen, gone into a good remission, they're probably not going to relapse for a long time. Maybe you don't need to scan them at all or quite so often, because chances are you're not going to find much on the scan. You have a relatively resistant patient who's had abdominal disease that you can't find very well, that you're worried that has a high likelihood of relapse. That may be a patient to scan more. But more and more, I find myself talking to my patients and questioning, can I skip a scan this time and just see the patient next time, examine them, and only do a scan if it's needed? So it's a great question. I think we need some prospective data. And sometimes this is do as I say, not as I do, because I think we are doing more scans than we need to do. But it's easy for us as physicians to order them because it gives us more information and we feel more comfortable that we know what's going on with the patient. But at the end of the day, is it helping the patient? Remains to be seen.
So we got a lot of great cases and questions about diffuse large B cell. Let me throw a couple of them out, beginning with a pretty tough one. 64-year-old man presents with stage 4 diffuse large B cell after 2 cycles of R-CHOP and response, has headaches. MRI shows parenchymal disease. Treatment options?
The management of secondary CNS involvement in lymphoma is one that is not well defined by prospective studies. The risk of having secondary CNS involvement with lymphoma depends on various features, but overall, in 100 patients with large cell lymphoma, the risk of CNS involvement is roughly 1 or 2%. It can be enriched, meaning if the patient has multiple high-risk features, including really multiple IPI risk factors and extranodal disease, remain the biggest risk factors. Now, if you have a patient that you're worried about prophylaxing, and then we'll get to treatment in a second, prophylaxing is something that is often done with intrathecal chemotherapy or with mid-cycle methotrexate, giving the patient 3 grams of methotrexate systemically day 14 of each cycle of R-CHOP is something that's increasingly done as prophylaxis. And in fact, there is a retrospective analysis out of Mass General published in Cancer in the last year or two suggesting good results with that approach. So that's also the approach I would take with a patient who presents with CNS progression in the middle of therapy. So if this patient is responding to treatment, their R-CHOP is handling their systemic disease, but is not handling their central nervous system disease, that's a patient who I probably would initiate with mid-cycle high-dose methotrexate. So you give the standard R-CHOP plus a 3 grams per meter squared day 14 of each cycle of R-CHOP as an inpatient with leucovorin, and that is what we've used in those cases, and that's been associated with pretty good outcomes. What you do at the end of treatment with that patient, if they're in remission, I think remains to be seen, i.e., you've treated their systemic disease, their large cell lymphoma is in remission. It really depends on how well you've treated their CNS disease, whether or not you'd follow that up with additional treatment versus just observe the patient. But the 3 grams per meter methotrexate is what I would use to manage a patient with large cell lymphoma.
So probably the most common question case type of thing we got on diffuse large B-cell. Here's a typical example. 67-year-old diffuse large B-cell, stage 3B, who needs R-CHOP, a cardiac comorbidity, ejection fraction 35%. We have a bunch of cases like this and people in their 80s. What's your preference?
So in a patient with large cell lymphoma, getting treated with anthracycline-containing chemotherapy or who needs anthracycline-containing chemotherapy but has a low EF, there's not really a standard approach. Many people over the years have used things like mitoxantrone and other new versions of anthracyclines. Some people have argued that just giving half doses of the anthracycline are reasonable. Wyndham Wilson would tell you that giving infusional R-EPOC is less cardiac toxic, giving the anthracycline over several days, and has some experience with giving R-EPOC infusionally at full doses in a patient with a cardiomyopathy. And I think that's certainly a reasonable approach, very carefully, I would add. But we typically use a regimen developed out of Stanford called CEPP, cyclophosphamide, etoposide, procarbazine, and prednisone. So it basically substitutes etoposide. There's also a CEOP, which is basically CHOP, but using etoposide substituted for the anthracycline with rituximab as well. I think all of those are reasonable. There's not one answer to that particular approach. The issue of an older patient who perhaps doesn't have cardiac disease, but let's say in their 80s with newly diagnosed large cell lymphoma, is one that, again, there up until recently has been very little data. But the GILA presented within the last year an experience of about 150 patients over the age of 80 with large cell lymphoma, where they treated essentially with half doses of R-CHOP, using full dose rituximab and half doses of the drugs in CHOP, again, reducing the doses for the patient because of age as the main criteria. And in that setting, about half of patients had several-year remissions doing well. And that's really the largest experience, a multi-center experience in patients over the age of 80, using essentially half doses of CHOP with rituximab. And that's a regimen that we've started to use based on those data, again, for the older patient, regardless of their cardiac issue.
35-year-old man with diffuse large B-cell stage 4 arising from low-grade follicular lymphoma in a resected node, achieved CR with R-CHOP, maintenance, radioimmune therapy.
I think a patient with essentially a de novo transform lymphoma, where they have large cell lymphoma and elements of a follicular lymphoma, who's in their first remission, who's had a good response to R-CHOP, which would be standard, is a patient who is likely to do well in the long term. The question of giving consolidation therapy for the large cell lymphoma component would not be standard, but for the follicular lymphoma might be standard, whether it's observation, whether it's maintenance rituximab, or whether it's radioimmunotherapy. I think all those are reasonable choices, as they would be with anyone who has follicular lymphoma who's in their first remission. I think the issues that come up in such a patient really relate to their preferences. Do they want more therapy or not? I'm not sure that there's an overall survival benefit to consolidation or maintenance therapy, but certainly just as in a patient with follicular lymphoma, I think the benefits of maintenance rituximab or radioimmunotherapy remain significant, at least with respect to progression-free survival. Personally, I think in a younger patient who's got an element of follicular lymphoma that I think I'm going to need to treat further in the future, I would be a little more inclined to use either observation or maintenance rituximab versus radioimmunotherapy, because I think there is some evidence that RIT does slightly increase the risk of secondary malignancies. And so that would be the one drawback or potential drawback in my mind. But again, either one of those approaches, observation, maintenance rituximab, or RIT would be quite reasonable. So I think it's a great question. I probably, in such a patient, would just observe them and reserve further therapy down the line. But again, there's no absolute answer based on data.
So a couple more quick questions. Here's one really interesting, thought-provoking quote. Here it is. Cunningham et al. At this ASCO showed that R-CHOP 14 times 6 was no better than R-CHOP 21 times 8. Can one conclude that since there was no difference between the two arms, that you only need 6 cycles of R-CHOP if you give it every 2 weeks?
The studies that have looked at R-CHOP on the 14-day schedule have been for 6 cycles. Most of the published literature with R-CHOP 21 has been with 8 cycles, although many people have adapted and used the 6 cycles. And in fact, outside of a study, I rarely, if ever, use 8 cycles of R-CHOP 21. So I guess my actions really support the idea that I don't think that when you're using rituximab in particular, that you need to use 8 cycles. So I would treat off protocol, et cetera, and large cell lymphoma with R-CHOP 21 for 6 cycles, I think is perfectly fine.
Final question, any thoughts about determining in diffuse large B-cell if it's of GCC or ABC origin?
So in large cell lymphoma, the gene expression profiling has determined 2 molecular subtypes, the non-germinal center or activated B-cell subtype and the germinal center subtype. The germinal center subtype has a more favorable prognosis. The activated B-cell or non-germinal center subtype has a less favorable prognosis. also been associated with certain pathways such as NF-kappa-B activation, and there's a national study looking at the use of bortezomib in that subset as an example. So determining the subset of large cell lymphoma, if you don't have access to gene expression profiling, which is not a clinically available test at this point, has really been done by immunohistochemistry. And I would say that that's a moving target. There was a model called the Hans model that looked at three markers by immunohistochemistry and suggested that they were very good. Various groups have tried to refine that model and have either ratified it or criticized it. I think it depends a little bit on the pathology. So I think today, outside of studies, we don't know that we should treat patients any differently based on those findings. And so, you know, you could argue that it doesn't really matter that much. And many very good centers don't even look for that because it doesn't impact their management outside of a study. On the other hand, I think the jury is still out, and the groups that are reporting this information as far as pathology groups really are using the Hans method, which looks at three markers and I think is probably a reasonable method, though probably imperfect. Again, what to do with that today remains to be seen.